Hi, Brandy. Welcome to the show. What is your earliest musical memory?
I remember attending group piano lessons at Tom Lee Music School, probably at the age of 5. And the teacher wanted us to decipher whether we were hearing a happy chord, a major chord, or a sad chord, a minor chord. And I remember thinking, okay, I got this, let's move on. I was eager to, you know, learn a piece of music.
Brandy, when did you start to develop a love for the bass? Was it one particular point in your life or a succession of events?
I remember first seeing the bass. I was probably about 6 or 7, and my family, we were at the Banff Center. I suppose my father was doing business there or something. He worked for Yamaha Canada for many years. And I remember there being a jazz trio on stage, and it was quite dark. And I remember thinking, and I distinctly remember this memory, being struck by the bass and thinking how beautiful this big instrument was. So then when my father asked me what I thought about switching from piano to double bass, they wanted me to go to Hanser Secondary in North Vancouver, and it was a notorious school for its jazz band, and the band leader there, Mr. Reb, taught Rini Rosnes, among many people. Anyhow, I remember when he proposed the idea to me, I was ecstatic. I was jumping up and down, and I was thinking, you know, how low down the bass sounded, how beautiful it would be, and just how much fun it would be to play it. I could immediately identify with being a bass player.
Who are some of your bass influences, and what did you learn from each one of them?
I learned from Mingus to try and be as crazy and passionate as possible on the bandstand. I always try and have that Mingus fire when I play and lead a band. I learned from Don Thompson, one of my earlier teachers, that I wanted to be a virtuoso of the bass and have over 4,000 songs and their melodies memorized. Most recently, I learned from Mr. Ron Carter that I wanted to play perfect bass lines with a perfectly round and relaxed sound every time I picked up the bass. And I love James Jamerson, and I learned from him that I wanted that infectious, funky, and uplifting feeling, especially on upright bass.
You know, one of my favorite bass players of all time and someone I have a great amount of respect for is Ron Carter. What are your thoughts on this genius of the bass?
Mr. Carter carries an altruistic commitment to pass on his knowledge. It's truly incredible. He demands an attention to detail far greater than I've ever encountered in all my years of training.
Any comments on the great bassist from the early period of jazz? Right off the bat, I'm thinking of the likes of Pops Foster.
I love Pops Foster. I play in a few trad bands here in New York City, and I love this type of music because it's so rejoiceful. I'm always smiling on the gig. One of my favorite early jazz bassists, other than Ellington's Jimmy Blanton, is Slam Stewart. Check out the song Laugh, Slam, Laugh.
So, Brandy, who outside of bass players have influenced your life and influenced your playing as well?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there are so many musicians, from singers to instrumentalists. I would say Charlie Parker and Art Tatum. When I want to listen to beautiful music, I'm often putting on these records. I especially love the Charlie Parker live records. I have a box set of him, and it's sometimes hard to hear the bass player or some of the detail because it's live at a club and perhaps not recorded the best way. So really all you hear is kick drum. And it almost sounds like hip-hop because there's this beautiful beat. In fact, I often joke around and I say, when I die and go to heaven, If you want to find me, I will most likely be playing in Charlie Parker's band. And I'd like to be his girl, too, when we get to that place.
So, Brandy, tell us a little bit about your bass. Do you consider your bass your best friend? And also, how old is it? And is there a history to it at all?
Well, first off, I wouldn't call the bass my best friend. The bass does hang off my hip bone, probably for an average of 6 hours every day. But I definitely wouldn't call the bass my best friend. I'll tell you why. I took a 5-week sailing trip this summer, which was incredible, as you can imagine. And that's the longest I've ever taken off from the bass, 5 weeks. I came home, and he punished me with 2 blood blisters on each finger. That's something to be said about, you know, the bass, what kind of an instrument it is, right? After years and years of playing it, you take 5 weeks off, and virtually it punishes you. My bass is a 1920s German Fretzner. And the Fretzner company was known for making bows. So there was only a few basses in the world. Before I owned it, I know Michael Moore owned it, and Rick Kilburn owned it. And I wish I would know who else prior. It's a gorgeous dark-sounding bass, but nothing fancy like some of those Italian basses.
I'm curious, how many basses do you own?
I own 7 basses, and I store them in various cities. And this, of course, helps when you're touring and you need a bass.
What are you listening to these days?
Lately, I've left in my record player Carmen McRae Sings Monk. I hadn't heard this album before, and I love it. I love Carmen McRae, and I love the lyrics, most of them being Hendrix lyrics, and I love the music of Monk, so I plan to start learning some of these songs, the vocals too.
You know, I have to agree with you, Brandy. One of my favorite albums ever has to be that Carmen McRae Sings Monk recording. It's a classic, and you just never get tired of listening to her, especially singing Monk's music. I want to talk a little bit about your writing now. Do you have a special process when you're writing music?
My surroundings affect my writing, whether it's current events or a strong emotion I'm feeling that day. Ever since I was little, I love to write fictional short stories. When I write lyrics, I'm often doing exactly that. Sometimes if I hear a harmony or a song that I just have to learn, I usually take part of it and create my own song. But I love composing. I find composing very gratifying and expressive. And often a tune will just come out and almost interrupt my practicing. I've written so many songs and take bits and pieces from each song, usually, to form, you know, a composition that I really love.
Do you ever have occasion to play electric bass? And which do you prefer? Do you prefer playing the acoustic or electric?
Last year I was playing the electric bass on some of my own live shows. I was singing and playing electric bass. But as a sideman, I don't get asked that often. I mean, sure, I'll play it if someone asks me to, someone hires me to. I love the acoustic sound of the upright and the feel-good jazz music that I play along with it. So naturally and instinctively, I'm first to pick up the upright bass.
I understand that you're currently living in New York City. So, what do you think about living in this great metropolis?
I love New York City. My mother, who is originally from Chicago, had always asked me since I was about 19 and moved to Toronto, "When are you moving to New York? Don't you want to play music in New York City?" I think you should give it a go in New York. My mother is a true American in the best way. She is a B3 organist, jazz pianist, composer, entertainer, optimist, and a determined woman. She is also the first band leader who hired me. As a true American, she goes after what she wants. She's not afraid to be outspoken or to get her point across. She always told us you can achieve anything you want in life. I love it here in New York City because on any given night, I can hear world-class music live, including the great legends. Or, for example, after I've been playing all day, working on some new lines, I can go hang out with my musician friends at the jam session until 4 a.m., just 3 blocks from my house.
Of all the bassists out there, who do you think has had the most influence?
Mr. Ron Carter. Mr. Carter has recorded, to name a few, with Miles, Joe Henderson, Horace Silver, Hank Jones, Jackie Byard, Lou Donaldson, Cedar Walton, Eric Dolphy. He's recorded those funky bass lines on Roberta Flack's Compared to What, which I record on my new album too. And more recently, he's recorded with Tribe Called Quest. I mean, he not only revolutionized modern bass playing, he's the most recorded bassist in the world. Everybody always says that Herbie made the Miles Quintet or Tony, but it was really Ron. Most of the time, he was the one who created all that tension and gorgeous harmony and, of course, the groove. We hear him all the time without even realizing it. Even here in New York City, you can watch and hear and then immediately recognize who has studied with him and been influenced by him. He is a composer and a band leader, leading many small groups, his octet, and most recently the big band. I would say Mingus also takes a close second.
What are some of your favorite recordings of all time that have really made an impact on your life as a musician?
Well, never mind top recordings. How about top songs or top compositions of all time? Pianist and my good friend, Lila Bialy, played me Chopin's Ballade No. 4 when we were in high school. And yes, she played it from memory at age 15. She was preparing for a classical musical competition. I don't know why I fell in love with it so much, whether Lila could emit all this emotion when she played. She certainly could and still does. Or perhaps when I think of the song, I think about her and her attributes, or perhaps our friendship. But every time I listen to that song, I'm just reminded how much I love Chopin. I mean, I could listen to that song, and I have listened to that song on repeat for days on end. Chopin has all that fire, the romance, the modern harmony, and then all of a sudden, bebop lines. If you haven't heard this song, I found in my collection the one that I keep listening to because he doesn't rush. You can't play Chopin too fast, especially these ballads. So this is Christian Zimmermann, and this is on a Dutch gramophone recording. Every time the melody passes, it sounds like a jazz musician beginning to improvise, and the song becomes more intense. So by the time the melody passes the third time, your stomach is just pulled down to your toes. It's so beautiful. And you hear these rip-roaring, descending bebop lines. I love it. And if I were to also pick one of my top recordings, it would be those recordings with the epic walking bass solos played by Larry Gales. and the beautiful comping, over top Monk's comping. So live at the It Club. And live at the It Club reminds me of exactly why I love the bass and why I love jazz music.
I'm curious as to the nationality of your last name. What are the origins?
My last name is anglicized German. And the name derives from Deisterhof, perhaps, or at least that's how the story goes. We never heard German music, and German was unfortunately never spoken in our house. My dad's family was originally from there, Germany, but they were homestead farmers in Alberta, and many still are farmers. My father, since he was 7 years old, had his own tractor and put in many hours contributing to the farm work. He even was milking cows at dawn before he went to school as a little boy. So I like to believe that I have developed the same work ethic as he has. But he studied trumpet at North Dakota University. And instead of German, I speak French. I mean, I love the Quebec culture. I do believe I'm a true Canadian, and I believe it's the best country in the world. Can you tell that I'm a proud Canadian? If I go back to my family's roots, I think of both my parents playing their American records. My dad, a former trumpet player, played his Maynard Ferguson, Freddie Hubbard, and Tijuana Brass records, while my mom practiced along to Bill Evans, Chick Corea, and Jimmy Smith. She's from Chicago, and she has that hint of Chicago blues, you know, that sound in her jazz playing that often you hear only in the older generation. I love it. So perhaps these American roots are the flavors in my music. I'm not sure.
One thing about your composition, Sketches of Belief, that really profoundly touched me was the way that it was organized and the way that the piece was structured. And I was just, Brandy, I'd really like to ask you about your comments about Sketches of Belief and how you came about writing it.
Well, thank you, Randy. It is gratifying to know that you enjoy my music. I really appreciate this. I do love Gil Evans, and there is that Lydian George Russell sound in the song. You're good. The horns are Chris Gayle on sax and William Sprande on trumpet, who play more perfectly than I could ask for. They make a beautiful team. And the inside story about how I wrote the song was I was ghastly heartbroken at the time. I had just moved to New York City, and I hadn't met many friends yet. I felt alone. My self-confidence was crushed. I basically started to believe I was a horrible person and that no one wanted to be around me. So therefore, I wrote this song, Sketches of Belief, as though to tell myself, don't worry, Brandy, everything is going to work out fine. Just have faith in a greater plan and pick yourself up. Move on. So I began to enter a state of belief that I was fine and that God or a higher power was looking out for me. The song popped out that night, and I used to play it on piano basically every other day for a few months following. I became addicted to the peaceful and therapeutic feeling that evoked from playing this song. And I usually start the song at my shows. Well, anyway, I used to start the song at my shows and in hopes that the audience would share this sense of ease with me. And there's a video to go along with this song. If you YouTube Brandy Disterheft Sketches of Belief. But the video, some people were confused by the video. The video is actually a puzzle. I wanted it to be sort of a silent film, like a David Lynch sort of murder mystery. And there's a soldier, and he dies. And the whole puzzle is, well, how did the soldier die? And I'll give you one hint, and that is the answer You can find it in Carol Shields' novel, Larry's Party. And Carol Shields being one of my favorite authors, and she's also a Canadian author.
Brandy, what music school did you go to, and what was the most important lesson that you learned while attending? Was there one teacher in particular that left a lasting impression on you?
I, for many years, went to Jim Blackley's house outside of Toronto in Barrie, Ontario. And he had a school there. I also, like a private school, or, you know, you'd go take lessons at his house. So I had a few lessons with him, lessons on bass with him, and I was lucky enough to regularly attend jam sessions at his house. And at that time, I went up with Toronto pianist Adrian Frugia, and I was really lucky to play with him and people of that stature, especially early on when I really didn't know much about, you know, well, I was still learning about what was going on. And Jim Blackley would yell at me, and he'd be like, "Dig in, lad!" And he would tell me, you know, if something goes wrong, give the guy next to you or give me a dirty look, me being Jim Blackley, give Jim a bad look. You know, it's all a game of confidence, you know, and especially when you're on the jam session, I think about that often. You know, jam sessions, you know, historically have been who can outplay the other person. So even when something goes wrong, and often that's when the music gets interesting. So even when something goes wrong, you just act like everything's okay and nothing's wrong at all. It's almost like a game. And this gave me a great start as a younger player to believe in myself and to believe in the sounds that were coming out of my instrument. Now I'm still going to jam sessions. I go to a weekly jam session at Vincent Herring's house, and musicians like Cyrus Chestnut come and play. And yeah, I mean, it never ends.
Is there any particular musical setting that you prefer playing in?
Honestly, I love playing with a rhythm guitar or banjo player. He's even more responsible to keep the time and the fat pulse in that sort of an ensemble. It's sort of like a hierarchy. I have to follow his groove. Unless, of course, he's wrong, he's dragging or something. But usually these guys are on their game. And it feels, as a bass player, like I'm on a vacation. I'm just surfing along with their time. It's absolutely thrilling because the band is cooking and I don't have to do all the work. This is part of the reason why my favorite gigs as a sideman are with trad bands, the traditional New Orleans-sounding Louis Armstrong bands.
Any funny road stories, Brandy, that you'd like to share with us today? I'm very interested because when I interview musicians and I hear a lot of different stories out there, there's quite a variety, and I'm sure that you have something that's very interesting that you'd like to share with us.
Okay, I have a good story. I've been working on my joke telling, actually. But anyhow, I'll tell you a funny story. I was on the road in Germany with Holly Cole. Probably we were out for about a month, and I was her bassist. And, of course, it was such a thrill to be backing up Holly, and I learned so much about being a band leader and how she puts on her show and how she arcs, you know, the sets. Anyhow, so two of the musicians in the band wanted to visit a friend, their so-called friend, in a small town, just a train ride away from the town we had just played in. And the following day, we had the day off. So I thought, well, hey guys, can I tag along and check out this different town? And so we took the train after the show that night, and we had a blast. We ended up at this Euro dance club, and we were dancing and enjoying, and you know, in the wee small hours of the morning, we came back to the friend's apartment and we crashed on the floor. Well, when we woke up later that morning, I realized that this so-called friend was basically, I think he was an artist as well. He was basically, well, you could tell that he was mentally unstable by the looks of his apartment. It was absolutely disgusting. It was putrid. The apartment hadn't done dishes for weeks. I mean, there was garbage all over the floor. There was manuscript paper everywhere. And there was this foul stench, perhaps coming from the plumbing problem. I don't know. It was just absolutely gross. I can't believe I had been sleeping on the floor. So he's getting ready to serve us brunch. And he's smiling, and he's a sweet man, and he's so happy to have house guests. And so anyway, he's like, I have some leftover stew. How about it? And he serves us this absolutely horrid-looking and not very good-tasting green and brown slop. And we were almost, like, in hysterics laughing because we didn't want to offend him. But at the same time, it was just so gross, and the whole apartment was so gross. So now I say to myself, you know, before I take these excursions outside of the tour itinerary, I'll think about it. I'll find out a little bit more of the details.
From a musical perspective, what was it like growing up in North Vancouver?
I had musical lessons every week in North Van, and I performed with my mom on some weekends, and I was always being picked on by my high school band teacher, who I think I've mentioned earlier, Mr. Reb. He was quite reputable, and he had taught Renee Rosness and Mark Rogers, Lila Bialy, and, you know, anyhow, he would make me cry on a regular basis, and he always wanted me to practice more. It seemed like no matter what I did, I could never, and no matter how hard I practiced, I could never impress him. You know, with all the hard work I was putting in. And I couldn't understand why I was being picked on, especially since I had already taken years of piano as a youngster, and I felt ahead of the game compared to some of my, or most of my peers, you know, in the high school band. Well, my dad and Mr. Reb were friends, and I didn't find out this until just recently, but my father told my band teacher to make sure you work her hard. And if you knew my dad, you would know what that meant. So something to the effect of probably make sure she's in tears, right? This is almost his sense of humor, but he wants me to work hard. So it was like this game they had going on for years to push me farther. And I suppose in the end, it did work out because I was awarded a scholarship to pursue music at Humber College in Toronto. And probably had I not received that scholarship, I would have been, I don't know what, a journalist or, I don't know, some entrepreneur of some sort.